Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Healthcare Committee. It is March 2nd. I can't believe we're in March already. June, July's right around the corner. Okay. We're going to have a great informational hearing, and I would like to open an informational hearing on exploring the cost drivers of healthcare in Oregon. And it would be nice if my committee would come in.
I'm right here.
She stepped out for a phone call, and the other stepped out for a conference. Just see if they're just standing there. But while we're waiting, let's bring the Oregon Health Authority up. Mark Fairbanks, Leslie Clement, and Jim Rickards.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Chairman Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Senator Cruz, and everybody else. We will introduce ourselves individually here to start off, and then I'll frame our presentation to you today and what we're going to focus on. So my name is Mark Fairbanks. For the record, I am the Chief Financial Officer for the Oregon Health Authority.
All right. Good afternoon. My name is Jim Rickards. I'm Chief Medical Officer, Oregon Health Authority.
And I'm Leslie Clement. I'm the Director of Health Policy and Analytics.
Great.
All right, very good. Well, we have a little bit of a presentation deck for you to guide us along. I'd like to also say hello to Oliver Droppers, former colleague and friend. And we're going to talk about cost drivers. And, of course, there's a lot of dynamics to the cost of delivering medical care, particularly in Medicaid. But we're going to focus on three primary drivers, and talk a little bit about those right now. Certainly pharmaceutical costs, which the pressure on pharma costs nationally and in this state is virtually a legend. We're going to talk about the cost of some new treatments and expanded benefits that have been included in the Oregon Health Plan. Those are cost drivers, and they put pressure on us to execute to our sustainability goals. And then there's provider reimbursement. Now, provider reimbursement is talking about almost everything else in terms of the cost of delivering medical care, hospitals, medical providers, behavioral health, dental, basically the cornucopia, I guess, of costs that you will incur when you're taking care of a population. And I'd like to also point out that the 3.4% growth rate that is included in the governor's budget is also a part of our 1115 waiver that has been renewed, re-executed, I should say. So we have a targeted sustainability threshold, and we work very hard with our CCOs and others to manage to that ceiling, if you will. The first slide will give you some reports to reference. We're delivering this to you and the committee to make sure you have ready access to the details that will really go behind what we're going to talk about today. There is a lot of information in these reports, and we recommend them to you. And I would also, not only as part of this presentation, but in any other time that the committee would wish to have more information or have us come back to discuss a particular topic, we are more than happy to do so. So with all that said, I will turn it over to my able colleague, Dr. Rickards, to talk about pharma costs.
All right. Thanks, Mark. So again, Jim Rickards, Chief Medical Officer for the record. Rising pharmaceutical costs are one of the drivers behind increasing health care costs for Medicaid. This is an issue of both increased utilization or volume of pharmacy prescriptions being written for, as well as increased price for individual drugs. The first graph up there shows how the volume of prescriptions is growing. From 2014 to 2015, we experienced about a 12% increase.
Before you go, I want to catch this on my computer, and I was just wondering, what is this report one? Report one. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I followed on my computer, too. Okay.
No problem. So, again, we're seeing the number of prescriptions go up over time. That's part of the cost driver. From 2014 to 2015, we saw about a 12% increase in the number of prescriptions written. Looking at this chart, the good news is the majority of the prescriptions for the Medicaid members are for generic drugs. Over 90% of all drugs prescribed are generics. And that's where we're seeing the increase in in volume. It's really an increase in the number of generic drugs written for. However, when we look at the total expenditures on drugs, the picture is a little bit different. Most of our expenditures are for brand name drugs. So while most of the prescriptions are generic, most of the expenditures are on brand name drugs, and that's largely due to the fact that brand name drugs are so much more expensive. So we see about two-thirds of all drug spending is for brand-name drugs. From 2014 to 2015, we saw about a 26% increase in the expenditures for all drugs. This gets a little bit into the complexity of how we pay for pharmaceuticals. The net cost increase we experienced from 2014 to 2015 was about 10%. When we purchase drugs for Medicaid and we try to control costs, we don't negotiate a better price, but we get a better price because of rebates. There's actually two types of rebates we receive. We receive a standard Medicaid drug rebate as part of the Medicaid drug rebate program. That's 23.1%. But then we also negotiate supplemental rebates with manufacturers to give them preferential placement of drugs on our preferred drug list. Typically, if there's more manufacturers offering drugs in a drug class, we get larger rebates because there's more competition. So again, the point is the price isn't lowered, but the rebate is increased, and that's what decreases the net costs. And we saw about a 10% net cost increase from 2014 to 2015. And so what the increased what we saw as a result of the increasing utilization and increasing prices from 2014 to 2015 is the percent of our budget that's spent on pharmacy is slowly increasing over time. We saw in 2013 about 15.9% of our healthcare spending was on pharmacy. That creeped up to about 18.6% in 2015. So if you remember, our goal is to stay under that 3.4% growth trend from year to year. We now have one area of spending that's increasing more than the other areas, at 10% a year, and taking up a larger piece of the healthcare spending pie, starting to potentially squeeze out other areas of healthcare spending. So, next slide now. We can see here we've kind of broken down the per capita cost increases by generic brand and specialty drugs. For 2014 to 2015, we had about a 7 to 9% increase per capita for generic drugs. This was largely driven by increased number of prescriptions or increased volume. The increased per capita spending for brand and specialty drugs of 19 to 21% and 26 to 28% was largely driven by increased prices on existing drugs and then also new drugs being brought to market at higher and higher prices. Hepatitis C is somewhat of a unique example when it comes to drugs. There's both a large potential volume of prescribing as well as a high cost for the drugs. The net cost for all hepatitis C medications had been hovering around $80,000 to $81,000 a year. This year, because new manufacturers have come out with drugs in the same class and we've been able to negotiate better supplemental rebates, we've seen that cost come down dramatically to about $31,000 to $32,000 for a net cost for course of treatment of hepatitis C. We'll go on to the next slide.
Question then. So are the rebate monies that you get back factored into that 7 to 9%, 19 to 21%, and 26 to 20%?
Yeah, that's looking at the rebates and the utilization, yeah.
So the rebate costs that you get back are factored into that still what your costs are going up.
Yeah, they're the net costs, yeah, increasing.
If I could, Madam Chair. One of the things that President Trump talked about Tuesday night was the cost of drugs, and we need to do something about it. But his focus was, as I was listening, on the FDA and them streamlining their process so that drugs could get to market quicker. Would you think that would have a significant impact on the price of brand if they had, let's say, 8 years under patent rather than four?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think when there's generic drugs in the marketplace, that helps drive down the prices. That's largely how we control prices now, is our preferred drug list preferentially places generic drugs above brand name drugs, and that's what helps us control costs. I think with pharma, one of the big problems is price. Price is the problem, even though we negotiate rebates and we can get better supplemental rebates. The price at which drugs are brought to the market, the sky is almost the limit. The FDA does review prices, but, you know, they don't really strictly set the prices. They look at safety and the effectiveness of drugs, but price remains a problem. So,
Madam Chair, I would suggest if you have maybe 4 years under patent before it goes generic, and you have a whole lot of R&D to cost to recover, the price would be higher than if you had like 6 or 8 years under patent, that you could spread out that cost over a broader spectrum and probably bring down the cost on the front end. And just one of the things I heard from the president that kind of encouraged me that we may see the FDA reacting to new drugs more the way they do in Europe. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. All right. Thanks.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator Beyer.
So it looks like that the biggest cost problem is the movement away from generics to specialty drugs. I assume in the formulary are we finding medically, are the specialty drugs that much better that they'd worth the cost?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's the movement from generic to specialty, but what we're seeing are new specialty drugs come to market for which there are no generics yet. When these specialty drugs come to market, they're coming to market at higher prices than ever before, and in some cases have no competitors on the market yet to help drive down the cost. We saw that with the case of hepatitis C when it first came to market. It was coming to market at a net cost of $100,000, $90,000. Very few competitors. Since there were no competitors, there was no reason for us or no reason for other manufacturers to try to negotiate supplemental rebates to get preferential treatment on preferred drug list because there weren't any competitors to compete with. So the issue is the new drugs coming to market, no competitors coming to market at higher prices than ever before. So so pharmacy is not just our only driver of increasing healthcare costs. We have a number of expanded OHP benefits and treatments. These benefits and treatments have come about as a result of either legislative action or changes that have come about through the Health Evidence Review Commission or the HERC. I'd like to just touch on a few of these benefits. One is applied behavioral analysis or ABA services to treat autism. This came about as a result of Senate Bill 365, which originally mandated coverage by commercial carriers, but also called for the HERC to evaluate the effectiveness of this treatment to see if it should be included as a Medicaid benefit. The HERC found good evidence for this benefit. Starting in January of 2015, ABA services were offered under a fee-for-service carve-out. Beginning in July of 2016, these services were incorporated into CCOs. CCOs are currently administering ABA services. However, there is a risk corridor in place with the OHA for 18 months. So we're evaluating that to assess the costs associated with this new service. Treatment of back pain or expanded treatment of back pain is another new service. In 2013, we had about 50,000 Medicaid members diagnosed with back pain. About 30,000 of them received opioids to treat the back pain. This was largely due to the fact there weren't a lot of other benefits available. The HERC, in a recent review, found other treatments such as acupuncture, physical therapy, occupational therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy were all beneficial for treating back pain, and that providing those services could help curb the use of opioids to treat back pain. So in July 1 of 2016, we started providing those expanded benefits. So we're going to be monitoring those to see how those costs play out. Hepatitis C, this is related to the initial discussion on pharmacy costs. Currently, we treat some limited stages of hepatitis C. Hepatitis C has 5 stages of disease, 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4. As you go up in number, the severity of the disease increases and also increases the risk that someone could go into liver failure or need a liver transplant. Currently, we cover stages 3 and 4. We do have some limited coverage of stages 0, 1, and 2 if individuals have a liver transplant or are pregnant. We worked with the governor's office to submit a policy option package to request additional funding to expand treatment to all of stage 2 disease. This is for $32 million.
Madam Chair, curiosity, if I could, because the ads I'm seeing on TV for Hep C basically talk about baby boomers. Is this specific to a certain segment of the population?
Yeah, so about 70% of all people in Oregon infected with hepatitis C are between the ages of 50 and 70 years of age. However,
yay us.
Yeah.
We're all supposed to get tested. Actually, the recommendation is that everybody 50 and older is supposed to get tested for hep C if you haven't been.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then but now the largest growing area is people under the age of 40 who are becoming infected with disease.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Largely because the largest mode of transmission now is intravenous drug use.
It was for our generation,
yeah,
too.
So. Yeah. So hepatitis C expanded treatment is another potential cost treatment or cost driver. And then expanded dental services are another cost driver as a result of recent legislative action. Funding had been restored to previous levels that were in place from 2003 to 2009, which now fund for a number of preventative dental services, basic periodontal services, basic restorative services, and removal prosthodontics or dentures. So these are going to be some additional drivers to increasing healthcare costs as we move forward.
On the back pain, I had actually a couple of constituents that have back pain, and they have switched to marijuana, medical marijuana, and it has eliminated their use of opioids. Do you see that? Do you pay for marijuana?
No, we don't pay for marijuana. And, you know, the HERC review really focused on benefits that are traditionally covered for by Medicaid, so the physical therapy, the occupational therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy. So those are the areas that we focus our evidence reviewed on and developed benefits for.
Marijuana is still Schedule I at the federal level.
It's not a medic.
I mean, that's what I wanted you to put on the record, that the reason you do not cover the expense of marijuana for some patients is because Medicaid will not cover that. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's my understanding you can't use Medicaid dollars to buy marijuana.
Right, that's correct.
So, all right, that's all for my portion.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Rickards. So again, Mark Fairbanks, CFO for the Oregon Health Authority. And for the committee, once again, there's a slide, I think it's the second slide in the deck from the introduction. It gives you some references, it gives you some links to some information that we are actually talking about in brief. The last report printed Q2 and Q3 that I would refer you to is the legislative report on our health system transformation. So a lot of information in here relative to demographics, quality metrics, satisfaction from members, finance, patient care, primary care homes, eligibility, enrollment, and more. So this information in the next couple of slides on the financial report really speaks to the CCO. Real quick thumbnail of operating margins and total margins. And you will note that the 2004 is the advent of the ACA. That is the advent of the increase in members for the expansion population. So you see a marked increase in operating margin and total margin. We've gone through this in prior months and last year in some detail around the rates. This is probably a phenomenon of a lot more people coming on than we had expected. And that is a national phenomenon, and as is rates. And the rates that were designed to cover that population were conspicuously absent to historical trends. So there was some rigor, a lot of rigor put around the rate-making process, but we have since developed a new rate model that some of you are very familiar with that really assigns, it analyzes base costs, it analyzes trends, it analyzes risk of the population in order to derive a rate. So it's really rate to risk in our model, and we have now had that rate model certified by our independent actuary in 15 and 16, and soon 17 rates are in process with CMS. They've also been approved by CMS, including the CMS actuarial unit. So moving on to the next slide, you'll see a depiction of a little difficult to read in the small print, but what you have are the CCOs, 16 of them listed on the right side of the page, and we are indicating here where net assets lie for each of 3 years. And you will note that right now the contractual requirement for a net asset level is 5% of average revenue That's the minimum amount of operating capital that's required by each CCO. There have been some discussions in other committees, and I'll refer to those now, in terms of where that rate may be. It was always the intention, and this predates me in my current role, but I understand that it was always the intention to move the net asset requirement to 10% of average revenue, creating a larger minimum amount of operating capital. The 10% is informed by the NAIC insurance standards across the United States and also insurance practices and the requirements of DCBS. And so, again, you'll find that 2014 is definitely the year that had the event of the ACA. So the numbers are quite conspicuously different. And as we go forward to 15 and 16, and I'm sure we'll see in 17, short of other major changes, a stabilization of margins. And that really points to the current level of focus beyond the cost drivers that Dr. Rickards mentioned, but also looking at all of the other drivers that I alluded to earlier in the presentation on the cost of medical services. This is where the work of transformation is happening. This is where the engagement with CCOs is the most intense to help drive down the cost of delivery, which has to do with how the care is delivered, where it's delivered, how people access it. It's changing the model. And so with that, I'd like to pass it over to Leslie Clement, who can talk about hospitals more specifically.
Are we assuming at this point that a 10% reserve is enough of a cushion?
Yes.
Okay.
Actually, Madam Chair,
mm-hmm.
I know that at least one, if not more, of the CCOs is also under the super regulation from DCBS because mm-hmm. they serve commercial. How many of the CCOs does that apply to?
Good question.
Senator Monta Sanderson, Chair Monta Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward in the committee. Off the top of my head, I'm going to just use names, I think, is the best way to do this. You have Centene, which is an owner of Trillium, and Centene is licensed insurance,
yeah.
So they are under DCBS purview. Moda has a small interest in Eastern Oregon CCO,
mm-hmm.
So there's another point of intersection. Pacific Source would be another,
mm-hmm.
and I'll have to look back on that and make sure I have them all identified for you.
Perfect.
So I'll get back to you.
Okay.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. But there is the other side. For example, in Umpqua, basically they own Trillium. So so there's ownership going both ways.
Right.
That is
absolutely
true.
It's complicated. And to some extent, that's partly my point, which
right,
is
right,
that there's a lot of intersect. Like the CCOs are not all purely Medicaid.
Yes.
That many of them have a commercial component as well, and that makes it a little bit more complicated.
And a Medicare component in some cases,
right,
as well.
In some cases.
So
as well.
Again, I would refer back to, I think it's the first quarter, the legislative report on healthcare transformation.
Okay.
There's a chart in this that actually shows you the 16 CCOs and their current state of ownership. And that's useful as well to see who's a C Corp, LLCs, and get some sense for the variety that was designed into the program to get it going.
Great. Leslie Clement, Director of Health Policy and Analytics for the record. As Mark stated, there are three links to hospital reports for your reference, and they include the Oregon Acute Care Hospital Financial Utilization Trends Report, the Community Benefit Report, and then there is also the Oregon Hospital Payment Report. I'll mostly be focused on the first two reports. The Oregon Health Authority contracts with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems to obtain the data that informs this presentation. The data originates from the data bank, and it's a vendor product out of Colorado that maintains data for 14 different states. It includes 26 of Oregon's 28 DRG hospitals. The Kaiser facilities do not produce hospital-level financial data. That's known as our Kaiser rule. It's an exemption in Oregon statute. This slide reflects changes since 2011 through 2015 in hospital operating revenue and uncompensated care. On the left, you'll see that from 2011 to 2013, operating revenue increased by 8.5%. And from 2013 to 2015, the operating revenue increased by 17%, doubling the rate of growth since the pre-ACA period. The chart on the right shows that since ACA, uncompensated care has fallen 65%. Next slide. This slide shows additional trends. The chart on the left represents total margin as a percent of total revenue. The total revenue includes money earned from non-hospital services such as investment income and tax subsidies. In 2015, the 26 DRG hospitals for which there is financial data retained 8.9% of their total revenue and profits. The chart on the right represents the dollar amount associated with that margin for the DRG hospitals. And the 26 hospitals had a combined total of $857 million in profits in 2015. Next slide.
Have you divided it out to AB hospitals?
These are just DRG hospitals.
Okay, DRG hospitals. Okay.
So I'm going to turn now to the topic of hospital community benefits. There are 11 categories of community benefits that include unreimbursed Medicare and Medicaid costs. These are often referred to as underpayments, health professional education, charity care, research, community health improvement, other public programs, subsidized health services, cash in-kind contributions, community building, and community benefit operations, which is administrative costs of the community benefit itself. These definitions are included in your report if you want to dig deeper into that. The chart on the left represents year-over-year change in total community benefit costs. The community benefit costs have remained flat since the ACA began, growing by a little under 1% from 2014 to 2015. And the chart on the right represents the proportion of unreimbursed cost of Medicare and Medicaid and how they contribute to the total community benefit costs. Since 2011, the unreimbursed costs of these two programs have become a larger percentage of the community benefit, growing from 53% in 2011 to 70% in 2015. State statute allows hospitals to claim Medicare unreimbursed costs as a community benefit. However, they are not permissible under federal tax code.
Senator Steiner-Harris. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Clement, if you took the, I'm sort of doing the math, but I'm just trying to make sure. So if I look at 2015, for example, we're talking about 70.4% as unreimbursed costs. And then in 2011, that was 53.1. Well, let's just say 2012, when it was, 57%? And then the... I guess the question is, how does that correlate with the totally unreimbursed care that we saw in one of the previous slides? Like, if you added those two together, would that... I'm not articulating my question really well. Unreimbursed costs could come either from under-reimbursement, right, which is one of the things that they're saying, or it could come from totally unreimbursed or charity care, right?
Right. Bad debt.
So... at the same time that the charity care has gone down, the percent of community benefit for unreimbursed costs has gone up?
Yep. Yes.
And is the thinking that that's because they are doing more Medicaid and that's a lower reimbursement?
Yes. Yes.
But they're getting some as opposed to none.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes. Chair Senator Steiner-Hayward, members of the committee, that's exactly right. What this chart really reflects is the increase in the numbers of Medicaid beneficiaries receiving care in the hospitals as opposed to pre-ACA when they would have been they would have come in as charity care or bad debt write-off.
Okay.
So it really is, it's not that they're not receiving any payment, they're just receiving underpayment is typically how they characterize Medicare and Medicaid, because they're lower reimbursement costs. But and they are getting paid versus no payment at all.
But they do add in that differential between what the reimbursement is and their actual costs.
Yes. I want to make sure I understand your question. They're all accounted for in terms of the components that we've discussed. So, okay.
Senator Beyer, had it. Yeah.
Okay.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So when we're basing that, the unreimbursed costs, it's unreimbursed from what basis? They're a set rate that hardly anybody pays, or what?
These are the cost to charges ratios. So
the person walking in the door, what they would pay versus what Medicaid or Medicare would pay or an insurance company?
Right.
So they're a little bit fictitious costs.
Senator?
Yeah, I would also suggest that the number has gone up quite simply because people that are now on Medicaid are probably accessing the system more than they were mm-hmm. when they had no coverage at all. So we're probably seeing more encounters than we were before.
Well, actually, if I may, Madam Chair, two things. At least the data that we have is that the emergency department visits, for example, have gone down substantially, and rehospitalization rates or avoidable hospitalization rates have gone down. And those are the sort of what they're called ambulatory sensitive conditions where the people are getting the care that they need in the ambulatory setting. So I think there may be some truth in what you're saying, Senator, some like surgeries, for example, elective surgeries that had been postponed, but I'm not totally convinced. But at the same time that this is happening, their net margins have gone up, right? So even though there's this theoretical, I mean, I'm not trying to be disrespectful to our hospitals. They're doing important work, and I'm just trying to make sure we understand this stuff as well as we can.
Right. Chair and Senator Steiner Hayward and members of the committee, I'm just flipping back to the previous slide. I think to your point, on the whole, with all these different components moving in different directions, overall the hospitals are doing better and their total revenues are increasing, as are their profits.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Cruz?
Yeah. Profits is an interesting term, okay? I am a businessman, and I like to make a profit so I can reinvest it in the business. Do you track the reinvestment they're making back into equipment and other things like that? So it's not just they're taking cash out of the system. A lot of it's going right back in. Is there any tracking of that sort of activity?
Chair and Senator Cruz, The financial report that you have, it's fairly thick and robust, and it will explain as much as we know about where the money is flowing to and from. When we're really talking about the community benefit, those are very prescribed categories. They don't include everything like new equipment or, you know, upgrading their facilities or adding staff, which they certainly have done over the years.
Yeah, I guess, Madam Chair, it's just a profit can be an evil word in some circumstances, and I know that like my hospital is purchasing new equipment all the time and trying to advance themselves. You know, they're at the present time trying to put in a robotic surgery, and that costs a heck of a lot of money to do that. So I think it's important that we know that a lot is reinvested back into improving facilities. So that's an important component.
Okay. So I'm going to continue talking about the community benefit a little further. The chart on the left shows the year-over-year change in charity care costs. So you can see we just discussed this. The charity care has fallen substantially in the 2 years since the ACA began. which is what everyone was projecting would occur. The total charity costs were $382 million in 2013, but it dropped to $157 million in 2015. And between 2013 and 2014, charity care fell 35%, and between 2014 and 2015, charity care fell another 36%. These are all connected to what we know happened to our uninsurance rates in Oregon. We did a tremendous job in getting people covered. The graphs on the right side show the proportion of the total benefit costs that can be categorized as direct contributions to the surrounding community. So the community benefit definition includes a very broad number of categories. These three categories are the ones that are actually investments and contributions made for the community outside the walls of the hospital. So together, the community health improvement, cash in kind contributions, and community buildings costs comprise about 4% of the total community benefit costs. So that concludes my comments on the hospital financials, and we'll be glad to answer any additional questions.
Well, I think they have been. Any other questions?
Yeah, we're not a shy group.
No. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Let us call up John McConnell, Director, Center for Health Systems Effectiveness from OHSU.
Chair Marnus Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, I'm John McConnell from the Center for Health Systems Effectiveness at Oregon Health and Science University. I'm a health economist, and the views here that I'm presenting are designed to represent a synthesis or summary of economic research and do not necessarily represent the views of OHSU. So I want to cover three things on drivers for healthcare: technology utilization and prices, talk a little bit about whether or not the data look like whether Oregon is expensive relative to the rest of the country, and then briefly touch on some policy options. So three reasons that healthcare goes up: technology, utilization, and prices. So technology is a major one that economists have identified, and this is a term that captures a broad number of things, including drugs, like we saw. Okay, thanks. In the previous presentation, and so over time, we have a lot of new things that come in, and they often are really nice. They reduce pain, they improve the quality of life, but they add dollars onto the premiums. And so the poster child for this is proton beam accelerator facilities. These are high fixed cost, low marginal cost machines. They're about the size of a football stadium. There aren't any in Oregon, but they cost about $100 million, and they're probably good for some rare cancers for children and for ocular diseases, but the real money is in prostate cancer screening and or prostate cancer treatment, and so you get paid a lot more to use this technology than you do standard radiation treatment for prostate cancer, even though there's no evidence that it's any better. And so this is sort of a typical trend in the U.S. is that we like technology, and a lot of times we use it. We probably use it in a way that maybe it should be limited a little bit more if we really wanted to get the value out of our dollar, but our payment system isn't set up in a way to really use things quite as efficiently. And so a lot of times we get new technologies and disseminate and distribute them widely. So that's, I think, a key thing for the panel to think about is as you think about how health, why is healthcare going up. There's all sorts of new things that are always coming on the market. Some of them are great. Some of them are maybe of limited value. Another one is utilization. Perhaps surprisingly, if you look at beds per capita or visits per capita or MRIs per capita or things like that, we're not necessarily worse than other developed countries. We're actually right around the median on a lot of these. But still, we have a payment system that's largely fee-for-service, and so this creates some perverse incentives to generally to do more intensive things to drive volume over outcomes. And so kind of a striking example of this, this was out of a newspaper story in Seattle. And so the graph on the left, these are charges, but they kind of serve as a proxy for utilization. These are neurosurgery operations charges in Washington State. And the graph on the left was total charges by physician in 2010, and the graph on the right is total charges in 2015. What happened in between there was that a hospital system purchased another hospital and recruited in physicians and really asked them to drive up revenues is using lots of surgeries. You can see a huge jump here, and so this is mostly Medicare, and so a lot of revenue was generated just by doing a lot of surgeries. Many of these surgeries were probably not necessary. A lot of them resulted in some bad patient outcomes, and so this was an article, I think, just about a week ago, where state regulators are now investigating some of the surgeons that were in this report. There's also kind of a concept of low-value care. So these are tests and procedures that don't have a lot of evidence around them, but we often use. This is a study we did in Oregon using Oregon data, trying to understand the prevalence of some of these treatment conditions, such as do you get a MRI when you have first-time low back pain? And we found that there were persistent geographical practice patterns, so that patients, if you looked at commercial patients in areas that were more likely to get MRIs for low back pain, Medicaid patients were also more likely to get the same treatment if they lived in that area. If you were in an area where it wasn't practiced as much, you were less likely to get it regardless of whether you're Medicaid or commercial. So it suggested that these things are sort of practice-dependent or practice-style-dependent. What about prices? So prices are not so critical for the Medicare and possibly the Medicaid market, but for commercial spending, it's really the main driver. And so you do see some correlation of utilization across commercial patients and Medicare patients. If you look across the country, some similar patterns of care, but very little correlation in spending. And that's because you've got some areas that are low utilization, but very high price. And price is really kind of the main driver when you look at commercial spending. So I think an important question is, are prices high in Oregon? You'll see a great presentation from QCOR says yes. I'm just going to run through some slides that are new. These are data from the Healthcare Cost Institute. This is a national multi-payer data set, and so economists are just starting to work with this. And generally, Oregon looks high. And so I just pulled a couple things. This is probably not a random sample, but just to give you some idea. So this is a primary care doctor visit. So Oregon, dark blue, that's kind of at the high quartile, whereas the lightest blue, Florida would be at the low quartile, so Oregon pretty high for this one. Here's a vaginal birth, which is a very common reason for hospitalization among the commercial population, so Oregon not in the highest, but maybe the second highest quartile. ED visits, sort of a similar type of thing. MRI, quite high here at the highest quartile. Hypertension bundle at the highest quartile. And then, as I said, I presented this before, if all this gives you heartburn, well, that's too bad because we're also at the highest quartile here. So some evidence suggesting that Oregon is on the high end for commercial prices. So why are prices high? Well, it's not clear exactly, but I think one model that economists would speculate is the market dynamics between insurers and providers. And so just to kind of walk you through this, you might imagine a market where there was a single insurer and a very competitive provider market, and the insurer would have power to push prices down. In contrast, one where there are many, many, many insurers, and it was a very competitive insurance market, and a lot of provider consolidation, providers might have market power, and that might push the prices up. And so Oregon looks a little bit like the latter. So like the rest of the country, there's been a fair amount of integration, both vertical integration with hospitals partnering with physician groups to form a single group, and then horizontal integration, which is hospitals forming bigger and bigger systems. And so Oregon's pretty similar to the rest of the country, but Oregon's insurance market is very competitive. And so if you look at, you can sort of break these down. This is from the Kaiser Family Foundation. If you look at the large group insurance market, Oregon's in the top decile in terms of competitiveness. If you look at the small group insurance market, Oregon is the most competitive in the country for insurance. And if you look at the individual insurance market, Oregon's 15th, so still at the top. So there seems to be a large amount of many domestic insurers and other insurers coming in, a large amount of competition, which might not give insurers a lot of push against providers. And so that may be one reason that prices are high. So that would be some
speculation.
In the previous slides that you had, was there a slide on pharmaceutical costs?
No, I did not have anything on pharmaceutical costs.
You know, in the study, where are we rated on that?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Knopp, I don't know of any study on that, but I can look into that and then send notes to the committee afterwards if you'd like.
Great, thanks.
Yes, Senator Steiner here.
Dr. McConnell, do you have any sense of how we rate on cost per care of a particular disease? I mean, it's one thing to say, and I don't disagree that these numbers are troubling, okay, don't get me wrong, but the question is, for example, if we have a patient with diabetes or hypertension, the individual visit is higher, but do we do a better job, for example, keeping them out of the hospital, avoiding the end-stage complications?
Senator Mona-Sanderson, or Chair Mona-Sanderson, Senator Steiner-Hayward, that's an excellent question. I think you'll see some data that gets at that a little bit from QCOR. They're looking at total cost of care, which is helpful. I haven't seen anything that talks about the sort of big disease bundle that you'll that you're talking about. Some of what the data that's presented in the healthcare cost in institute data looks at bundles a little bit like that, but not really the whole trajectory of care. But I think that's a really valuable way of looking at care, and that's one of the suggestions I have in the policy options.
Thank you.
Yep. So the graphs before looked at statewide variation across states. This is not a perfect graph, and I think the point here is just to tell you that there's heterogeneity within the state. It's not that all hospitals are the same. These are data from the Oregon Health Authority, who collected data on differences in procedure costs. Peter Graven from our shop rolled these up, and so this is some graphical measure of sort of a unweighted procedure average cost by hospital, and the basic metric here is light pink is sort of the lowest cost, and dark black or dark red is higher cost. And so it just gives you some idea, kind of in the Portland area, more competition, things are a little bit lower than the state averages, and then you see some darker areas spread out in areas where it's a little bit more rural, the hospitals are more isolated. Hmm. So I do want to make a comment on cost shifting, because I think this is sort of comes up quite frequently, and so I want to say three things about cost shifting, and this is a little bit technical. The first is a question of whether hospitals cross subsidize, and so if you've got good payments for one service, do you use that to cover other services? And I think there's pretty good evidence that suggests that's the case, that sometimes hospitals get paid well and they use that to cover burn units or trauma units or psychiatric units or things like that. The second is Oregon's hospitals underpaid by Medicare, and this is something that I think we often wonder about, because Oregon looks like a low utilizer place relative to the rest of the country. And there's a study that just came out in New England Journal of Medicine within the last month that did some sort of creative statistics where they looked at people coming from other parts of the zip code to see how other parts of the country to see how they were treated, did some statistics, and what they found there was that Oregon really is sort of a low utilizer, and that the current risk adjustment doesn't capture all of that. And if you did things adjusted for some of the fact that Oregon generally uses fewer tests, fewer screening, records fewer diagnoses, that Medicare Advantage payments should be about 10-15% higher than we think they are right now. So it tells you something about the state, as it's generally a low user of tests and low recorder of diagnoses relative to some other states. And then the final thing is, final point that I want to make
That was
fast.
So, well, no, I got what you were saying, and it kind of is going at what I was asking earlier, which is to say, does that mean that we end up with worse outcomes because we do fewer tests, or better outcomes because we do fewer tests? And, you know, I mean, if you think about something like Gawande's article in The New Yorker in January about the heroism of incremental care, which is really about outpatient management of chronic diseases, for example, the kinds of conversations that you have with patients who are managing chronic diseases allow you to avoid tests, for example, sometimes that might otherwise be quicker but aren't actually better care. So I don't know how that ties in.
Chair Mona-Sanderson, Senator Steiner-Hayward, the evidence looks like outcomes are pretty good. This is using mostly Medicare data. Outcomes are pretty good for patients in Oregon, and the real issue is that Oregon physicians are less likely to do tests and then record diagnoses that show up in claims data.
So they do the test, but they don't show the diagnosis.
They might do the test, but they're just not. They're not doing as many tests, or they're not recording as much in the data that would show this patient has one extra comorbidity. Even if the physician is aware of that and managing it appropriately, it's not showing up in the data. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. But outcomes, if you look at mortality and things like that, outcomes look pretty good.
Thank you.
No. Okay. And then the final point around this is one around cost shifting. And cost shifting, economists have defined fairly narrowly, which is the notion that if public reimbursement rates go down, either in Medicaid or Medicare, do we see, is there a justification that would say that that commercial payment rates should go up? So does this actually happen? And this has been an area of a lot of debate, but lots of research over the last 10 years in the economics literature, generally not finding a lot of evidence to support that, suggesting that high commercial rates can't necessarily be justified by decreasing public payment rates. In terms of policy options, I think these are – I'll just touch on these fairly quickly. I think we should be concerned about provider market power. There's consolidation happening around the country, and I think that should be monitored. Payment reform should be supported, so there's a lot happening in Oregon. I think that some efforts to move away from fee-for-service are beneficial. If we look at the other country around the country – apologies – accountable care organizations and some commercial versions of that look moderately successful. They're not panacea. Is, but we're seeing decreases of 1%, 2%, 3%, and I think groups are learning how to get better outcomes. There may be benefits from good network design, so narrow networks are sometimes controversial, but we often see that as a way to lower costs without having better, without having worse outcomes. And then finally, I'll mention that I think that there's some value in using the state's All Payer All Claims database to understand where cost drivers are coming from. 3.4% is an ambitious benchmark, but it is a number, and it would be helpful to know what the rest of the state spending is doing relative to that benchmark. We know that CCOs are hitting that mark, but we don't know much about the commercial market. We can use the All Payer All Claims database to answer that question, answer those questions, understand if there's significant overuse in certain areas. As Senator Steinmeier-Hayward mentioned, I think understanding how increases are driven by certain disease groups would be really helpful. So if we see increases of 3.4% on average over 5 years, are we seeing specific increases in the area of cancer or cardiovascular disease, or are they staying flat or perhaps going down? It might be good or beneficial, or we might like it if we saw increases in spending on preventive care. So not all spending increases in spending are necessarily bad. And it might be beneficial if we saw increases in spending on areas like cancer, if we saw quality improve in that area too. But right now we don't really know much about the trends across disease categories. And finally, I think that understanding what type of accountability fits into the Oregon way is really useful. I think that Oregon, my experience as I touch other states and see research on other states, Oregon remains different both in the way it approaches health care and the way that providers are generally willing to come together and discuss policy options. And I think that we can learn something from other states, but would be nice to see Oregon adopt its own method for addressing these issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much. No further questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Let us call up Meredith Roberts, Tomasi, and Doug Roop.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and Vice Chair Cruz and the rest of the committee. Thank you for inviting us to present today. My name is Meredith Roberts Tomasi, for the record. I am a Senior Director of Programs and Operations at the Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation, or QCOR for short. Today we'll be sharing about what we've learned about Oregon's healthcare costs in the commercial market. So this will be a little bit different than what you heard earlier today from OHA about the Medicaid market. QCOR was founded in 2000 as an independent nonprofit whose mission is to improve the quality and affordability of healthcare for all Oregonians. We do that by collaborating with all stakeholders around the same table. We have found that this type of collaboration is the most effective when tackling Oregon's trickiest healthcare problems. Since 2008, health plans have been voluntarily submitting claims data to QCOR. Today, we'll be focusing on the commercial market. So currently, we have about 80% of the fully insured commercial market, which includes most of PEB and OEB. We have 35% of the self-insured commercial market in our data. And then for Medicaid, we have 100% of the data and 92% of the Medicare data. So our data is pretty robust. This means that we have historical patient-level claims data for most Oregonians, and this enables us to track patients over time between private and public insurers and between health plans.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Could I just ask you a quick question? The self-insured commercial population, so that's the ERISA population?
That's correct.
And you don't have those data because they don't go into the All Payroll Claims database, or because the TPAs don't release them to you, or all of the above?
A little bit of all of the above, but primarily different insurers, different TPAs have different approaches to what they submit to our database. So we have some of the self-insured market, but certainly not most of it.
Thank you. I'm sorry, one more question.
Sure.
So what percentage of the total Oregon population do you think you cover, therefore, with these data?
I want to say 64%, but I can verify that for you.
I think it's actually higher, because I think it's about a quarter of the state that's insured on TPA, on ERISA. And basically, our state breaks down a quarter Medicaid, a quarter Medicare, a quarter ERISA, and a quarter other commercial. Pretty close.
Madam Chair and Senator Steiner Hayward, Doug just whispered into my ear that he thinks it's about 65% of the commercial population, so probably about 80% of the overall population, but I can follow up with you on that.
Good enough. Thank you very much.
It's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people.
Right. Enough to clearly be representative.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. So in the past, QCOR has focused primarily on quality measures. In 2013, we expanded our measures to include cost for the first time. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation funded the Network for Regional Healthcare Improvement to initiate a study comparing commercial healthcare costs across regions. Oregon was one of the 5 pilot regions. Since then, this work has spread to an additional 9 regions. In Oregon at QCOR, our cost work is guided by our Total Cost of Care Steering Committee, a multi-stakeholder group made up of 19 members, including physicians, health plans, consumers, administrators, and researchers. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the basis of our work without going into too much detail on methodology. Health Partners is an integrated health system based in Minnesota. About 20 years ago, they developed a total cost of care framework. This framework allows for a standardized method to look at all costs for all care for a panel of patients and compare those costs to an average. Total costs can be broken into 2 components. The resource use component is a measure of the frequency and intensity of services delivered. The price component is affected by things such as fee schedules, referral patterns, and place of service. These measures are risk-adjusted for age, sex, and illness burden, and they include services delivered across all settings, inpatient, outpatient, professional, and pharmacy. They also include all payments made by both the insurer and the patient. These measures were endorsed by the National Quality Forum in 2012 after rigorous testing explicitly for the commercial population. Once we were comfortable with the measures, the first audience we wanted to share the data with was primary care clinics. This summer, we delivered the second round of clinic comparison reports to 176 clinics across Oregon. This reflected data from 7 commercial health plans. These reports include not only costs, but also quality and utilization metrics compared to the Oregon average. We are committed to always showing costs along with quality. We provided a sample clinic level report for your reference in the materials we submitted today. I'm now going to hand it over to my colleague, Doug Rupp, who will talk more about what we've learned and a national benchmark report that was recently released.
Senator Steiner.
Thank you so much. You said 2 rounds of reports, 2013 and 2014, have been sent out. So is the lag time 2 years?
Great question, Senator Steiner Hayward and the rest of the committee. So we are getting ready this summer to deliver the 2015 reports, and a few months later, the 2016 reports.
Okay.
There are a few factors going into the timing. One is certainly claims lag. The other is some vendor performance issues. We are switching vendors, so we hope that timeline is greatly shortened in the future.
Great, because it's not very useful if you're looking at something that's 3 years old.
We completely agree. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Moniz, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee, my name is Doug Rupp. I'm Senior Healthcare Analyst at QCOR. In addition to reporting on clinics, as Meredith mentioned, we've been looking at other ways to look at the data. Our Cost of Care Steering Committee asked us to look at the relationship between cost, and quality. And to do this, we took the primary care clinics where we could report on cost and looked at their total cost index compared to a quality index that QCorp developed. The results are shown on this scatter plot where cost is along the bottom and quality is on the vertical axis. And each of these diamonds represents a clinic in Oregon. And if cost and quality were highly correlated, we would see clinics line up in a line. But that's not what we're finding. They're scattered out across the chart. So, for example, for clinics on the right side of the chart where costs are high, there are some that are low in quality and some that are much higher in quality. So based on our data and what others have found, high cost does not correlate with high quality. The section of the chart that's most interesting is the upper left quadrant, because this is where clinics are showing low cost and high quality. Ideally, we'd want everyone to move in that direction. We looked at where clinics were located around the state and found substantial variation among the regions in the state, as well as among clinics within any particular region. If we look at the urban versus rural clinics, in general, rural clinics have higher cost, but there are exceptions to that. Not all rural clinics are high cost, and not all urban clinics are low cost. And there may be legitimate reasons why there's this variation and why costs are higher in general in rural areas. Provider compensation variations may play a role. Infrastructure requirements in areas where there's a small patient base may not be used optimally. And there may be lack of services, of certain services, that are leading to other higher cost services being used. Next, we'd like to look at the National Benchmark report that was released in January. Some of you may have heard about this.
Can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Did you correlate the level of certification as a patient-centered primary care home as part of that calculation?
We've looked at that a bit, and the patient-centered primary care homes clinics do better on quality.
I mean, that's what the Portland State article suggested, and I was just curious whether that matches up with what you're seeing, whether the more of the low-cost, high-quality, or level 3 PCPCHs.
There was more of a variation in cost, but definitely they were higher on the quality overall.
Got it. Thank you.
So the national project that Meredith mentioned released a 5-region comparison on commercial healthcare costs. Compared to the other 4 regions in the study, the QCorp results show that Oregon is higher in cost than 3 regions and lower than 1, Minnesota. And breaking down this total cost into utilization and price components, Oregon shows lower than average utilization, but the highest of the 5 regions on the price component. And these results, I think, are consistent with the HCCI study that John McConnell just shared. The study further broke down costs into service categories for inpatient, outpatient, professional, and pharmacy. On the resource use component, Oregon is about average or below average in all categories, meaning resource use is lower. That's for the price component. Oregon shows around average or above, and inpatient is the highest at about 27% higher than the average of the 5 regions. So,
question.
So these are preliminary results.
Yes, Senator Knope.
Can we go back to that last slide?
Sure.
I'm just looking at the pharmacy as it relates to costs. It looks like Oregon is below average in cost and pharmacy in this study. Do you know what you can attribute that to?
Chairman Moniz Anderson and Senator Knope, we don't have a thorough understanding of what's happening in pharmacy here. So again, in the resource use component, it is quite, Oregon is quite a bit lower. And then on the price index, Oregon's about average, slightly below average on the price component. These measures are a little bit difficult to interpret on the pharmacy side, just because the resource, when we're looking at resource use components, we're talking about if a patient gets one cheaper drug instead of a more expensive drug, rather than you know, the actual prices that for the scripts. So we need to do more investigation on that, and I'd be happy to share that when we understand.
Yeah, I guess I'd rather be on the below average on cost on pharmacy than above, because I know, you know, people are talking about the high cost of drugs, which, you know, it is out there. But if we're below cost as a state on pharmacy, I think that's at least a good thing. So there's not all bad news out there, it sounds like.
Madam Chair? So now I'm confused again.
Okay.
If I'm understanding this correctly, and I just did the arithmetic on one of them to make sure I wasn't wrong, the price index is the TCI as the numerator and the RUI, the resource utilization, as the denominator, right? You divide resource utilization into total cost index, mm-hmm. and then you get the price index.
Correct.
So to some extent, that feels a little bit misleading, because in a lot of cases, I mean, outpatient, if you look up at total cost index, we're a little high in some areas, but we're definitely lower in others. And in resource utilization, we're definitely lower. So it's basically because our resource utilization is low that our price index is high.
Chairman Moniz Anderson and Senator Hayward.
Don't worry about it. It's okay. You got the committee with the most complicated names. It's okay. Keep going.
That is what our results are showing, and there have been other studies that have shown that in places where resource use is low, prices are higher, and that may be part of what's happening here.
Because in essence, it sounds like we're paying people to think and not do, which is not necessarily a bad thing.
That would be. So the prices for services end up being higher because we're not performing the services that aren't necessary.
Okay. Just to let you know, I mean, we still have one bill after this, and I want to get through all of the speakers here. Please proceed. Okay.
All right. So we did talk about some of the cost drivers, and I think John McConnell went through those pretty well. Just on the rest of our work, we'll be expanding to Medicare and working with other stakeholders around the state, working on making costs more transparent across the country. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. With that, let us call up Josh Balik, Art Sujorzewski, and who's the guy? Sean Colmer. I forgot.
No.
Okay. No. All right.
That's close enough, Chair. thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. My name is Art Sujorzewski, and I'm the Government Affairs Director for Family Care Health. Since 1984, Family Care Health has coordinated health benefits and services for lives covered by the Oregon Health Plan. As the second largest coordinated care organization, we contract with thousands of health care providers to provide integrated physical, dental, and behavioral health care to approximately 120,000 Oregonians in the Tri-County area, as well as parts of Marion County. There's no question that hospital and pharmacy costs have been increasing significantly every year. While utilization or the number of services provided contributes to rising costs, increases in the price or the individual unit costs are by far the largest contributor to rising health care costs in these two areas. Rising hospital and pharmacy prices are a problem for all payers, including commercial insurance, and other government-sponsored programs like PEB and OEB, not just at CCOs. With regards to FamilyCare's pharmacy experience, total drug costs rose 21% for FamilyCare in 2016 compared to 2015. Utilization actually declined. So while average price paid increased by 22%. So price is the driver at FamilyCare Health. CCOs have done as much as they can to manage and compensate for these unsustainable price increases. All CCOs have very high generic issue rates, at or above 90% in many cases, and have other pharmacy management protocols in place that require the use of the least costly medicine as supported by medical evidence. For FamilyCare, the increase in pharmacy prices alone account for more than the 3.4% increase in global budgets. While containment of pharmacy prices, without containment of pharmacy prices, funding available in the global budget for other providers will decline, and Oregon will be sending all of its global budget increases to out-of-state pharmaceutical companies. Similarly, hospital prices rise unchecked annually due to the current DRG and cost-based reimbursement methodologies. Hospital prices continue to rise even in the wake of falling charity care and rising hospital profits, as described in the OHA's testimony. We recommend a few things for the committee to consider when tackling this important issue. First, tax-funded healthcare should be considered as a whole, and we believe that regardless of whether an individual is on OHP or on PEB or other state-funded healthcare, all Oregonians more or less use the same hospitals and same drugs that are driving up the costs. Secondly, we would recommend that the committee consider creating a statewide pharmacy benefit manager. This would be a statewide contract for all drug prices with management of those drugs staying at CCOs and other government agencies for all tax-funded health care, and study how this might have a positive effect on drug prices. Lastly, we would recommend that you look at limiting hospital costs in the same way we have capped Medicaid at 3.4%. One of the examples is in Maryland, where hospital rates are set by a state agency known as the Health Service Cost Review Commission. Within the last 2 years, Maryland has even moved to implement global budgets for hospital reimbursements. While pharmacy and hospital prices are the most popular cost drivers, there are other cost pressures as well for us, whether it's administrative burdens or inadequately funded new benefits. All of these have cost pressures for FamilyCare Health. Ultimately, all of these cost pressures could reduce available resources within the CCL's global budget to invest in prevention and in social determinants. All of these have the greatest potential for a long-term reduction in demand for healthcare services. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. And
thank you, Art. Questions? Josh.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Palak, Vice President of Government Affairs and Health Policy for All Care Health. We are a CCO located in Southern Oregon. We take care of Jackson, Josephine, and Curry County, and a little bit of Southern Douglas. So I broke your computer, so I'm sorry. And now as a result, I can't show a video that I really wanted to be able to show to the committee because in essence...
On OLIS?
What's that? It is not on OLIS. I am a slacker, so I apologize, and I will get you a copy of the video, and you guys can watch it. And it really is worth it. In essence, it was a video that actually talked about a woman who ended up having cancer in her mouth, and she ended up having part of her dentures or her teeth removed, and she needed a partial denture. And they actually couldn't do it in Southern Oregon. You had to – the only place that could do it was actually up in Eugene. So the problem was Donna, who was this woman's name. She couldn't – she wasn't being able to eat. She was losing weight, and she was ending up in a clinic. And so one of our community health workers actually met her and said, hey, you know, let's try to work together on this. So this was back in 2014 or – 2014. And Donna ended up getting dentures fitted and set and done up in Eugene in one day. We actually coordinated medical transportation for her, to non-emergent medical transportation, to get up, get it seen, set, and then out. And quite frankly, when I talked to all of the folks who had been a part of this, they all said pre-CCO, this woman would have passed away. She would have fallen through the cracks. And that there was, it was really funny when we were doing the filming, everybody walked past Donna, who might weigh 100 pounds, and they all didn't recognize her because she put on so much weight. And she was the really excited because she actually got to go to her son's wedding and could smile for the photos. And the really cool thing is you guys, this committee and actually the Senate, the Human Services Subcommittee actually passed a measure to actually fund those partial dentures. So the way we took care of it was with Flex Services, but you guys actually passed it. So now that's covered so that everybody like Donna is going to be able to get access to that care. So just want to say thank you for doing that. But I guess the main cost driver that I really want to be able to warn folks about here is going back to the old way. I mean, what we've built inside of the coordinated care model is really remarkable. We've already saved the federal government $1.9 billion. According to the study that I've seen, already saved the general fund about $300 million. We're projected to save the general fund $600 million in the next 2 years and the federal government another $2 billion. This is real savings that the coordinated care model has really created. And I believe that protecting and making sure and fostering what we're doing inside of the coordinated care model is the best savings we can possibly do. And then just as one other side benefit to this also has been in Southern Oregon, we've seen a huge drop in the uninsured rate. And in Josephine and Curry counties, it is actually less than 1% for uninsured folks in our community. And in counties where they still have a pretty high an insurance rate, still is one of the main reasons for medical bankruptcy. Our bankruptcy is medical bankruptcy. So just think about the economic drivers and the economic things that are being able to be taken care of because so many people are insured. They don't have to worry about bankruptcy. They're able to go and create jobs and do things along those lines. So, I think the one thing that I would say is protecting what we've done, protecting the investments that we've made are really critical. It is resulting in general fund savings. It's resulting in a lot of federal savings. And quite frankly, we should be going back and having trying to share more of those federal savings with the state because we are the ones that are saving the money. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
No, thank you. Art, could you send your remarks?
Yes.
To the committee administrator.
Yeah. Yes, I will. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you
very much. All right. No comments. I think this was extremely valuable information, and I'm really glad that the committee was able to hear it. With that, I'll close the informational hearing, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 743. Oliver, would you please summarize the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 743, the measure creates a violation for the retail sale of dextromethorphan, an over-the-counter cough medicine, to minors without a prescription from a healthcare professional. It would require businesses and their employees to verify whether an individual attempting to purchase dextromethorphan. Thank you, Senator. Is 18 years of age or older, and the bill would also establish fines for individuals and businesses. There are two amendments opposed on OLIS.
Okay. Madam Chair, yeah. I'm just confused because I actually bought a cough medicine containing dextromethorphan the other day because, as you know, I was pretty damn sick, and I got age checked, so I thought it was already the law here, so I'm really confused. When I saw this bill in the schedule, I was super confused.
Well, John Powell and Carlos,
they wouldn't let me self-check out because it said, we don't know that you're 18. I'm like, yeah, I think 18 and then some, but okay.
It could be very simple. It just requires somebody to be able to say the word before they can buy it.
And I can say it, though.
Please proceed.
Senator Monis Anderson, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is John Powell, representing the Consumer Healthcare Products Association, and with me is Carlos Gutierrez, an executive with the association. Senate Bill 743 is a bill we are sponsoring and support. And I believe on OLIS there is a dash 2 amendment, which the nut of the issue remains the same, but there are some changes that have been made to address some stakeholder concerns. And I think we'll need one more small change before we have it hopefully ready to roll without opposition. So briefly, the issue is, I guess, a chemical called dextromethorphan. For the rest of the hearing, we can just shorten that to DXM. And with that, I will hand it over to Carlos to summarize the issue, the problem, and why this bill proposes a solution.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Carlos Gutierrez. I'm the Vice President of State and Local Government Affairs for the Consumer Healthcare Products Association of Washington, D.C. We're the trade association representing the over-the-counter medicine manufacturers, including the manufacturers of dextromethorphan, or DXM. Obviously here in support of Senate Bill 743. Just by way of background, DXM is it's a safe and effective ingredient found in many cough and cold medications on the market. It was approved for over-the-counter sale back in 1954 by the Food and Drug Administration. It's a non-narcotic, it's not addictive, and it has no pain-relieving properties to it. So it's used safely by majority of Americans, millions of families that use it nationwide, nationally, annually, I should say. And we support full, unfettered over-the-counter access for adults. We think it's an important ingredient. It's great for cough, and so we do not at all want to interfere with that access. It is, however, a medication, and like with any medication or substance, it can be harmful if not taken as directed. And unfortunately, a few years ago, we began to notice that the teen population began abusing it. In fact, when we began our campaign on this issue, teen abuse was around the 6% of teens had admitted trying to get high off of dextromethorphan, oftentimes taking 25 times a recommended dose, or basically chugging a whole bottle. You might be familiar with the term robo-tripping. It's Robitussin, and they trip off of it, robo-tripping, and there's a number of names for it. So when you take that amount, it obviously can produce hallucinations, confusion, blurred vision, excessive fatigue, and even some loss of motor control. So when this was brought to our attention, we obviously took it very seriously. And we began to voluntarily place a warning label on the side of the medication to warn parents, caretakers, and even the teen population that that it can and has been used for abuse. Started a website, started a teen campaign, very sophisticated awareness campaign, and then we began supporting laws such as the bill before you today that would ban the sale of dextromethorphan to minors, over the counter at least. If they have a prescription, they could still get it. 12 states have now passed this law nationwide, including your neighbors Washington and California. Five others are considering it this session, including Nevada. So it could be a total of about 17 states online by the end of the year. Like the Community Anti-Drug Coalitions of America, Partnership for a Drug Free, the National Association of School Nurses, DARE, and many others have strongly supported these measures around the country. And I think the best point is that it really has worked. Teen abuse, since we started this campaign, has actually been cut roughly in half. So it works. We know it works. And while we're proud of the fact that that abuse has dropped, we know that there's new teens coming in every year that are going to be tempted to try this. So we find it important to try to limit that ability as best as possible. So I think our campaign, combined with this law that's before you today, makes great sense to us. The retail community around the country has been a strong partner. One of the reasons you couldn't buy, even though you are over 18, or that it's not law yet, is many of the chain drugstores are already requiring it as a policy. So this bill would essentially mandate it amongst all pharmacies so that there's no loopholes in the system. So I think it could make a real difference, and we would appreciate your support on it.
Great. No comment?
I'm just curious what the other changes that needs to get made.
Yeah, can you describe the amendment?
In the E-2 amendment to the bill, section 3 is a section that a specific retailer asked and we said we would put into the bill, which would allow a requesting retailer to contact the association for a list of all products that contain this. And there's just some wording issues with that section.
Got it.
Pretty simple fix.
Okay.
And what's the one that's coming again? You said there's another.
That's the only change.
Oh, that is the
to the dash 2 amendment, and then I believe it will be ready to go.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And so as soon as those amendments are ready, there's no opposition to the bill. If the committee is in favor of this, then we can put it for a work session. But we'll need the amendments first.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, I'll close the public hearing on 743. Is there any other items that I need to discuss? We're adjourned.
That was a really
I need to discuss. We're adjourned. Thank you.